Yeah, it's not so different.
A little cheaper, maybe.
Yeah. So I guess there's no exchange rate for rock. You know, there should be a table so we get like euros, dollars exchange rate.
I'm Garth Mullins. This is Crackdown. Episode 5, The Portugal Paradox. It's a sunny April morning in Lisbon, Portugal. I'm in the Sete Rios district, with tree-lined streets and fancy hotels. I've come to Portugal looking for answers. Nearly 20 years ago, the Portuguese government decriminalized the simple possession of drugs for personal use. Ever since, the very word Portugal has become a kind of shorthand. It's a demand for a kind of drug user liberation, a yearning to end prohibition. BC's top health official, Dr. Bonnie Henry, recently called on the province to follow Portugal's lead and decriminalize. She said that decriminalizing possession would help curb overdoses. Crackdown's editorial board was curious. What's it actually like over there? And so I hopped on a plane. The first place I check out is called the Dissuasion Commission. I'm here with Sam and Lisa, two of Crackdown's producers, and Enrique Pintquil, a local journalist and translator. Inside, it's basically a waiting room, like a doctor's office. There are three teenagers in a group. Enrique walks up and says hello. At first, they're a little shy about our microphones, but one of the guys introduces himself. Let's call him Manuel. Manuel is 18, he's wearing a black hoodie, and just like me, he's never been to the Dissuasion Commission before. He doesn't really know what to expect.
So I was sent here, and I have to obey the law, and laws are laws.
I ask Manuel how he ended up here. He says he started to smoke hash about a year ago when he was 17. He mostly just likes to smoke at parties, like the one he was at just a couple of weeks ago.
He was enjoying the day before Easter. They were all together in a park in a Lisbon suburb. And it was night, and they were making noise and drinking and smoking. I asked him how many of you were in the park, 8, 9, something like that. We're not normally in a big group, it's just us. But then all of a sudden there was a car with the intervention police, and they were kind of abrupt, and we were all surprised because they were using shotguns. They put us on against the wall, and it was kind of scary. And they just asked us, do we have something? I was the first one saying yes, I do have substance, and I asked him how much did you have, and then he said, well, there was very little amount. It was less than a gram of hashish.
A gram costs about $10. Not much, but one of Manuel's friends had more, like $300 worth. Manuel says the cops confiscated their drugs. They detained the group and took them back to the police station. Manuel's buddy is charged with a crime. He's told he'll have to go to court, but Manuel had less than 5 grams on him, and that means that instead of court, he has to come here to the Dissuasion Commission. A tall, handsome-looking guy in his 40s appears in the doorway. This is Nuno Capaz, one of the people who runs Lisbon's Dissuasion Commission. I'm surprised to see his sweatshirt, stubble, and hiking shoes. For some reason, I expected a suit.
Do you mind following me? We have a larger room where we can sit.
We walk down the hall and into a kind of boardroom. Nuno sits on one side of the table and gestures for Manuel to come in. He looks like a kid who's been called into the principal's office. Alert, but not too nervous.
He says, please come closer. Please, I insist, have a seat here. These are just radio journalists, and I'm going to be a little more formal than I used to be. And you know why you're here, right? You were caught with a little hashish. Do you finish junior high? And he says, yes. But not the academic one, the vocational one, which means the professional stream. And do you live with your family, with your parents and your brother, right? And he says, yes. And is your email this one, Febras with a Z? Febras means pork chops. Pork chops with a Z. Nuno says, well, regarding your record, you know, this is an administrative sanction, right? This is just like a traffic sanction, like driving without your seatbelt, you know, because this is the first time you have been warned. This is a first situation and you are not a regular. We are going to suspend your sanction.
This means Manuel won't have to pay a fine. He's told the commission that he doesn't have a drug problem. It's just a recreational thing. Nuno seems to accept that, and that means that Manuel won't have to do any treatment either. At least not at this time.
Yeah, Nuno insists if you show up here a second time, you would get an actual sanction. He says everything just like in the ads on television about medicines or aspirins. They have to read the small letter thing. It's a blah, 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 blah.
And then Nuno slides a piece of paper and a pen across the table. For the first time, Manuel looks a little worried.
Am I okay? Is going to happen anything to me? And he says, no, it's just part of your record. It's okay.
Nuno tells Manuel that the commission has social workers and psychologists. If he starts to worry about his hash use, he should just give them the call. Manuel responds that he actually has been having a rough time lately, but that he's already seeing a psychologist. He signs the paper and slides it back to Nuno.
And finally, Nuno says, well, done. From our part, I think it's everything. Nuno says goodbye and go for it. Forza. Forza means strength. May the power be with you.
Can we let him go? Thanks for talking to us. I'm sorry the cops pulled guns on you. No. This happens where I'm from too.
Yeah. Forza needs a success.
Make a big success.
Thank you.
Thanks. What did you think of the Dissuasion Commission?
So thinking about this, like if we were in Canada, for sure cops coming up to people with guns and that kind of the interaction that happened that the kid tells us about, that seems familiar. But then it's the different streams of what happens next. So the guy, his friend who's holding more drugs, yeah, he's going to court. He's going to the regular criminal justice system, and I guess that would happen here. But he doesn't. And at the Crackdown editorial board, we have a lot of people who've had lots of interactions with law enforcement and jail time that are kind of related to possession or around that sort of stuff. And, you know, Dean Wilson, who's on the board, likes to say lots of drug users end up doing life in 3-month bits. And that just doesn't happen in Portugal. And that's pretty amazing.
And what do you think about the people that we saw in the waiting room?
It's different than what I thought it would be. You know, like I didn't think that we'd encounter a waiting room full of kids who are smoking pot, basically. And I didn't realize that that's 90% of what the commission handles. So Nuno, the first thing he seems to want to figure out is someone an addict or not, as he says, and is someone using opioids or not or hard drugs? And then they kind of stream them in two ways, and there's lots of people that come through, and it seems like it's just a rite of passage, you know, that it seems like a trip to the principal's office. So it just seems like most of what they do is kind of lecture kids not to smoke so much pot.
Right, which is why I'm glad you asked Nuno what would have happened if it had been someone like you who had come in to the Dissuasion Commission when you were a young adult instead of somebody like Manuel.
So me, I used injection heroin for over a decade. If I was a Portuguese guy, what would have happened to me here?
Well, if you were caught by the police in the possession of less than 1 gram of heroin...
Probably not. I had a gram a day habit.
Okay. So, but you're probably buying several times.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fairly sure where normally people, normally drug addicts don't buy a huge amount of drug at a time.
Yeah.
They normally buy smaller doses. So if you would be caught, you would be notified to be present here, and eventually you would make a suggestion of referral to some sort of treatment.
So
which could include a week or two cleanup program. It could include also a methadone program, substitution program, if you wanted to enlist a 12-step program, living 1 year in a therapeutic community on the countryside, that would also be available, all planned and all without gaps in between, so you don't relapse in those periods.
So it took me a long time till I was really able to stop doing heroin. I'm still on methadone now.
Okay.
And I hope that I would take what was offered to me, but I also know that I haven't always done that.
Yeah.
If I just didn't show up at the methadone bus, or if I was just, you know, not complying with what the dissuasion commission was suggesting,
okay.
Do they send a letter to me and tell me to come back?
Well, that's what would happen if the person is not willing to get back to treatment or restart treatment. We will probably have to apply a sanction to that person. And normally the sanctions we tend to apply for drug addicts are the regular presentation. It means that the person has to check in with a certain institution on a regular basis, like once a week or something like that.
I don't mean to continue down this road, but I had a probation officer, and I don't think I made every appointment.
Yeah.
Maybe I made half of them, you know? And I'm like kind of in the middle. I'm not the most fucked up, you know?
Not also the more compliant one. I understand.
Yeah, I'm not the most compliant. Yeah,
I would say that, we do not work as a probation officer.
Yeah.
But our role legally, it's more or less similar. But again, we work under the Ministry of Health.
Yeah.
So if you do not comply, you do not continue or under the jurisdiction of the Ministry of Justice or a court system.
So there's no path that leads me to jail
for
this.
No. For usage,
over a gram.
No. For usage, no. People thought that when we decriminalized drug usage, they thought, oh, so people can walk around with less than 5 grams of hashish from now on. And it's not like that. We couldn't just do that because that would be against the international conventions that we signed. And so there's this list of illicit substances, and there has to be some sort of penalty for people that are caught with it. But the international conventions doesn't say that you need to have criminal sanctions or a criminal record.
You personally, beyond the international relations piece of this,
mm-hmm.
do you think that it's the right thing to do, to have an administrative process?
Yes, I think it's much better than having a criminal one.
Is it better than having no process, do you think?
Yes, I think so. In some cases, yes, because we can do, because by having the process, that allows us to do an assessment of the sort of users. There are people who have problems with the substance that they are using and that therefore should benefit of some sort of follow-up meetings, motivational meetings, referral, treatment, counseling, whatever. It depends on the cases. And an administrative offense procedure seems to be the proper legal framework to deal with those situations.
So what did you think of what Nuno was telling you there?
I really tried to get Nuno to tell me how I was going to jail in Portugal. And there's no way to get there. So I think that was really something, but I kind of learned from him that he operates a big sieve and he's trying to sieve out, I guess, people like me. We stay in the sieve and all the kids who are doing pot, the 90% go through. And then he's trying to divert, as he says, people who have who are wired in one way or another, using opioids or something all the time, try to divert them to different programs. And he says he kind of puts the energy in and leans into that more.
But if you are caught with more than a gram, you are not going in the same sieve.
Oh, yeah, different. You're just going to jail.
Fish.
So, according to Nuno, if I was a Portuguese dope fiend, I would have probably been referred to a low-threshold methadone program. In Portugal, that means meeting a methadone van at one of the scheduled stops. And so I came to this empty, windswept parking lot on the outskirts of town. We're near a highway and some treeless vacant lots. About a dozen people are waiting around. Some are sitting on the curb and others are in their cars. A white van rolls up. It looks kind of like an ice cream truck. People get out of their cars and off the curb. They form a line at the window. There's a few pretty obvious differences from my methadone clinic. For one thing, there's the dogs.
Oh, look at that little guy.
Most of the people just drink their juice and leave. So after about half an hour, almost everyone's gone. Except for one guy. He's wearing neon yellow and blue cycling gear. And he flags me down.
Yeah. He's in a rush, but he's going to talk to us.
You need to translate? Or?
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
I'm Emmanuel.
I'm Garth. Good to meet you.
Yeah.
I'm taking methadone too in Canada.
When I say the word Canada, his eyes light up. He starts air drumming. But it's as if his drum kit surrounds him, like in 360 degrees.
Rush.
Rush?
Rush?
What,
that's a band?
Yeah, right.
He pulls out his phone, scrolls around for a bit, and hits play.
This is right, não conheço.
Eu também não conheço.
É sério? Isto é o melhor baterista do mundo.
The best drummer in the world.
He's not much. The best.
Me and the guy are both air drumming now. And another man wearing a dress shirt and a lanyard looks over at us, puzzled. He says he's never heard of this song before. And the bike guy says something in Portuguese.
You're a bunch of assholes. You don't know him.
He's shocked because I don't know the band.
The guy with the lanyard is Hugo Fria. He's a psychologist and team manager with the NGO that runs the methadone program here. Hugo says he's really more of an Arcade Fire kind of guy.
This location, it was synced because it's near a trafficking neighborhood and using area over there, behind that building.
Hugo points across the field to a couple of public housing towers. Some people come from there and some people come from further away. Even walking up to 30 minutes to get here. Hugo says they only do a piss test on the first day here. They hand people a cup, and if they want, they can find somewhere to pee, maybe behind the van, and bring it back right away. I tell them it seems a lot better than Canada. When I wanted methadone, it was just easier to get it from a drug dealer than a doctor. Hugo nods. He says he doesn't worry about the black market methadone.
So you said there's no black market for methadone?
No, there is a black market.
Oh, there is. Okay.
You don't care?
No problem for us. For some of them, it works. It's better than to inject every day with heroin.
This blows my mind because in Canada, the doctors and the people who run the methadone program, they hold it tight in their fist.
That's why the problem is. It's like the law of the oferta e procura, I would say, to find and like the economical
supply
law.
And demand.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you hide your products, everyone will want it, and there's a lot of side markets, black markets.
Yes.
It. Yeah. If you give the methadone to everyone, or if everyone can get methadone easily, there's not a problem. This is a medication. People need this medication. People need very much this medication. So we have to provide it.
So it seems like if you lived in Portugal, you would have probably ended up at the Dissuasion Commission and they would have likely sent you to this methadone bus.
Yeah, and that's great because right now there are like two parallel tracks, or they have been in my life, where you get hassled by the cops or you get some kind of entanglement with law enforcement, and then separately you have to go fight your way onto some kind of methadone program or some kind of treatment. You know, and I suppose there's drug court, and that maybe sentences people to some kinds of programs, but I think for the most part, even opioid substitution treatment isn't really available everywhere and as easily as it should be. There's still a lot of rules and a lot of things to trip you up if you try and get on it. There isn't someone who, if they catch you with drugs, will actually try to get you to be on it.
You really think in the 90s that you would have been okay with being sent to a dissuasion commission and going to the methadone bus?
You're right. It probably would have taken me missing my dissuasion commission appointment and then not going to the bus and stuff like that. But I mean, I was buying diverted methadone and lots of people do. So to start you down that path instead of a path to jail would have been definitely preferable. After visiting the dissuasion commission and the methadone van, I start to think about VANDU. So many of the programs we have in Vancouver were won by the city's drug user activists. So if you want to understand what works and what doesn't in Canada, these are the people to talk to. And so I wanted to talk to people like that here in Portugal. I walk across town in the rain looking for a drug user center called In Moraria. By the time I reach the center, light rain has turned into a downpour and I'm drenched. Two guys concede that I need to get out of the rain and invite me inside. In Moraria is basically the size of a living room. It's got lime green walls and some low-slung couches. Someone is sitting on pretty much every surface in the room. It has a little sandwich assembly line going in the back, just like at VANDU. And there's coffee. Most people, like me, are pretty drenched, but happy to be inside. One of the guys behind the desk hands me a green plastic envelope. It says, Reduzao de Riscos. That means in Portuguese, reduce the risk. It's a little kit with syringes, water, citric, cookers, cottons, and a condom. A woman in her 40s bounds into the center and says hello. She introduces herself as Magda and says, let's go next door. It'll be quieter.
You want a lighter?
If not now. You have if I need?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's cool. Not now.
Yeah.
We walk through a door and it smells like a lumberyard. New construction, bare plywood on the walls.
Can I have a look around in the facilities?
Yeah.
To my surprise, there's a sink, a stainless steel table, and cupboards. It's a supervised injection room, easy to spot, even 8 time zones from home. Magda tells me this place is brand new and it's not sanctioned yet.
Okay, so my name is Magda Ferreira. I work to GATT in Moraria. I was invited to work as a peer counselor. And as a woman, for my community, for the people that use drugs.
You said you were you're a drug user.
Yes, I'm
well,
a drug user.
What's opioids, heroin, methadone, me, what about you?
My school, at 12 in high school, I started smoking hashish, tried cocaine first time at 13, and then I was hooked on heroin when I was 16, smoking and sniffing heroin, because I thought only inject drug users would get hooked. There was no harm reduction at the time, no information at all.
Magda says that no one really knew what to do about her addiction. At one point, she was sent to a farm to detox. It was kind of like a work-based therapy thing. But some of the people there could be nasty, and one of them hit her, so she fled and relapsed. Psychiatrists tried every combination of antidepressants they could think of. She said it felt like they were going to fry her brain.
Portuguese society was trying to learn how to address the problem of drug use, you know. So,
do you think it has?
It has, you know, what worked in the beginning, I think it was amazing that we decriminalized the drug use, of course. That was a super cool thing. Mm-hmm. We are very well known abroad because of it.
That's why we're here, yeah.
Yes, it worked. Things became a little bit better. The government helps you. There's a process if you want to go to treatment. They provided needle exchange to people. Even doctors were learning how to deal with us, to deal with the situation. Families had to be teach also how to deal with the problem, you know.
And of course, it worked in one way.
But in another way, it didn't. It's still illegal to sell drugs in Portugal. In fact, the government pitched decriminalization to the public as a way to free up resources, so cops could spend more time chasing dealers and traffickers. That means that drug users in Portugal, just like in North America, got to buy their drugs on the black market.
It's like it's a paradox, you know. It's like a gray area.
So prohibition is still alive and well in Portugal.
Of course it is. You know, you are even in the questions of violence. I saw that now the dealers are young boys that grew up in the ghetto, you know, and they don't respect drug users at all. They hit them, you know, hardly. They want to break your pride completely. I'm from a time where people use drugs to enjoy. So I don't understand why. Like, you know, to live with shame and with stigma and to be discriminated, it's even more toxic than drugs, you know, and I felt that. In this job, I felt accepted in my choice, and I end up healing a lot of things, getting rid of a lot of labels that I have put it in myself. The first one was shame.
Yeah, I really agree with you, and I'm starting to notice that in this job, I have to talk about my drug use, and it's changing that in me too.
Yes,
you know,
because it's the way to empower out other drug users, you know, and it's not our fault that the drugs we like are illegal. I will like drugs forever, but I can't let drugs use me anymore. So I want a little bit more. I want more for me, you know.
Thanks for so much time with us.
Thank
you.
No, yeah. It's
okay. In the side.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, I have a dog that will be far.
I'm in the northern city of Porto to meet up with Rui Miguel Coimbra Moraes. Rui is on the board of CASO, Portugal's only drug user union.
Okay, we go.
Yeah. Thanks for taking us, Rui.
No problem.
So, when you talked to us earlier, you said that you could tell us about the dark side of the Portugal model. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
What's the dark side of the Portugal model?
Well, the dark side is that the implementation of the policies is growing in paradox. So we have this on the law that is a bit schizoid thing that you can buy and it's not a crime, but where do you buy it? Heroin doesn't appear on trees and on supermarkets. To buy, you have to go to places where a violence environment is concentrated, you know, dealers, users, and...
Such as where we're going.
Yeah, yeah.
So Rui is in his 40s. He wears a t-shirt and a suit jacket. It's a look that works in a room full of politicians, but also in a room full of drug users. I do the same thing sometimes. While we drive, we start talking about the old days. Like me, Rui did a lot of drugs when he was in grad school.
Back at that time in Vancouver, I was using heroin most of the time. What were you doing here?
The same, but at the same time doing other things. And with heroin, I managed to be using and studying and working for a long period. When I started using cocaine, I put a dealer in my apartment.
Oh, wow. So the dealer was your roommate?
Yes, the apartment was mine, and he needed a place.
So that probably fucked up school pretty quick, hey?
Yes, I have destroyed myself a little bit.
Six months later, Rui had no money, no dope, and his veins had collapsed. He eventually got into residential treatment and started taking buprenorphine. For a few years, all he did was the odd line at a party.
Did your veins come back?
Yes.
Not mine. They're gone forever. I don't know where they went.
They're to the inside of the body.
Yeah. Yeah.
How afraid of you?
I think they are.
Last year, I found the vein, but then I fucked up the vein pretty quickly. Now I'm finding in different places, but I'm taking care of them so that I can use till 200 years.
The car winds through the Portuguese countryside until the fancy hotels and tourists disappear. Rui pulls over to the side of the road.
What neighborhood are we in right now?
Bairro do Cerco, neighborhood of Cerco, Siege.
Siege, like a battle. Rui says it can feel a bit like you're under siege here. The cops even sometimes set up checkpoints, blocking all the entrances and exits to try and catch dealers. As we get out of the car, off in the distance, I see a ruined building.
Sort of a old brick and concrete structure with no roof.
This is graffiti, old stone.
Granite
stone. We make our way through a couple of smashed rooms, rubble piled in the corners, grass growing everywhere. The ground is strewn with garbage, including hundreds of those little green plastic envelopes containing harm reduction supplies.
This is the place of use, and if when it's raining or something, it's very crowded.
Yeah.
Injectors go to the cave.
So you smoke there and you go to the go to the cave?
Deeper into the smashed structure, on one side is a small room with around 10 people. They're sitting on a low ledge against the walls. They're passing around a pipe and they invite me to join the circle.
Yeah? Can I just sit here? Hey. What? How much do you come here to this place?
Yeah, how often?
Every day?
Every day.
And so what's it like here?
Here?
Yeah.
Space. Like many people come here.
Hello.
But the convivium.
It's friendly. Yeah, so sometimes people share.
Yeah. And that's not very, it's not so usual among users of cocaine.
A wiry woman wearing a bedazzled tank top and Chuck Taylors walks up to us. She tells us that Kazo hired her to work in the space.
I clean everything, I put everything in.
And you're giving people, like, supplies if they need?
Yeah, I'm just me. Clean alone the space.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I like do these things.
So it means you have
I like help the people. So.
And then all of a sudden, a flutter of anxiety ripples through the group, but I can't tell what's going on.
The police is there, and so people are a little bit stressed.
Where's the police?
In the neighborhood.
Oh, let's get the fuck out of here.
No, it's no problem.
No?
No.
This is where I come from. When the police come, we leave.
Everybody do that.
Yeah.
Rui explains that somebody saw cops patrolling the neighborhood just outside, and they had their shotguns out.
They don't take people's drugs away?
Sometimes.
Yeah. Have you had your drugs taken away by the police?
Yeah. Yeah.
How much? How often?
Two times. It's about 10 years in drugs, so not more.
Well, thanks very much for talking to us, and
welcome.
I'm glad that you do this for the people. That's that's great. Thank you.
Welcome.
I've shot up in places like this. There is one ruined warehouse in San Francisco I can still remember vividly. It's the same thing. It must be miserable here when it's raining. And I know what it's like to grind all day, doing risky and undignified shit, just so that you can huddle in this kind of place, to keep the dope sickness away, and to hide from the cops. In North America, we dream that there's a place where this doesn't happen. And I guess I hope that Portugal would be that place. After hanging out in the ruins for a while, Rui and I walk back to the car. And on the way, we start to talk about fentanyl. There's nothing about the Portuguese system that prevents the same kind of thing from happening here.
In Vancouver and in North America, we have so many people dying from the overdose crisis, fentanyl and stuff. You don't have that here yet, but one of the things we're asking for is a safe drug supply so that people won't die from fentanyl anymore. Do you guys?
I know guys that search fentanyl, even if they have heroin. I was recently in Bucharest, and the guy was asking me, but I have fentanyl, why it's much stronger, why do you want heroin? And
yeah, we have people who want fentanyl as well. And it's not fentanyl itself, it's the unknown quantity. Mm-hmm. You know, so you don't know how strong it's going to be. And if it was regulated, you know, if it was legal, then you could get, fentanyl, I know how strong it will be. Heroin, I know how strong. You know, cocaine.
Should be regulated. It makes no sense that this lie of prohibitionism that so more than 100 years of lying that begins with commerce, not with worries about human condition. And for me, it's still the commerce because it created a so huge monster of making money for some that it's difficult to regulate because there's lots of interests.
Rui agrees that drugs should be legal, regulated. But there isn't the same sense of urgency here about that, because there isn't nearly the same death toll.
Thank you.
Thanks. Forty-five years ago, there was a revolution against fascism in Portugal. 20 years ago, there was a revolution against the drug war. But it's not complete. Drugs are still illegal in Portugal. Drug users are still marginalized. Vancouver and Portugal both did something amazing 20 years ago. In Vancouver, it was the fight for a safe injection site. But those moments have become calcified, institutionalized. In some ways, activists have been written out or tokenized. Meanwhile, the crisis deepens, overwhelming North America and creeping across Europe. When I was 19, I was caught with drugs and thrown in jail in California. I can still remember the moment when I realized that almost all of the 27 guys in my pod were there for some kind of drug-related offense. And almost all the guys in the pods above, beside, and across from us were in there for drugs too. The pods were stacked into wings, and those wings extended into complexes. And those complexes stretched out across the desert, just an endless sea of cages to hold people caught with drugs. We need to empty those jails of drug users. Canada needs to stop arresting 100,000 people every year for drug possession. But it can't stop there. Drug user activists in Canada and Portugal and everywhere else, we know that the world needs a safe, legal drug supply. Those moments in history, defeating fascism or decriminalizing drugs, they're beacons. They show what's possible. We need to remember that revolutionary spirit. This song, broadcast on Portuguese radio in 1974, was the signal to launch the revolution. We need to broadcast that signal again. Crackdown is produced on the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Usually. But this episode, we were in Portugal, and all that travel ain't cheap. If you like what we do, please support us on patreon.com/crackdownpod. And thank you to those of you who already have. You'll find bonus content there, and it's always free. Crackdown's editorial board is Simona Marsh, Shelda Caster, Greg Fess, Jeff Loudon, Dean Wilson, Dave Murray, Al Fowler, Laura Shaver, and Cherise Kiwatin. R.I.P. Cherise.
Crackdown is produced by Alexander Kim, Lisa Hale, Sam Fenn, and Gordon Caddick. This month, our lead producers were Sam Fenn and Lisa Hale. Sam, it seemed like you were talking to an awful